Access number 30283, Rill 5.
Thai Priest, Rill 5, Saigon.
Yeah, we used to land in Saigon, which was quite, because it was early to mid Vietnam War times. So you'd coast in over South Vietnam, and very often you'd find a couple of American fighters sitting on your wing. You didn't know they were coming. You just suddenly appear there. A couple of voodoos would come and have a look at you. Going into the into Saigon. And pick up fuel, and that was an intensely interesting place because it was a civilian airport with all the girls in their lovely Bao Dais, I think they're called, their long Vietnamese costume, but wall-to-wall military. And I can remember going on the taxiing, the guy, the controller controlling the taxiing, was just talking non-stop. You had to be very swift to get a word in, because on the main runway they had all the big aeroplanes, and Pan American 707s and American transport aeroplanes, and ourselves used to land on the long runway. Halfway down the long runway you'd have medium sized aeroplanes, little twin engined transport aeroplanes landing and taking off, and then sideways would be smaller aeroplanes would be coming in, bird dogs and things, the American spotter planes. And you'd also have big swarms of helicopters taking off. So it was an incredibly interesting place. You know, everything going on. You couldn't get a word in edgeways on the RT. And again, I had an amusing experience with that, because in the early days, I got airborne with the squadron commander to go up to Hong Kong. And the navigator was a guy called Vic Fontes. Now, Vic was the navigator. And he was an ex-wartime Polish guy who'd obviously escaped from Poland and flown in Bomber Command. And at one stage, when Bomber Command was a big thing, he'd been the Bomber Command heavyweight boxing champion. So he was a big lad. But Vic was a law unto himself. He was still a flight lieutenant. And the morning had started with us getting on the aeroplane, all in our flying suits, all immaculately dressed, because we were flying with the squadron commander. And Victor got on the aeroplane dressed in his shorts and shirt. So there'd been a confrontation between the squadron commander and Vic. So the atmosphere, until Vic had changed into his flying suit, with some bad grace, I might say. So the atmosphere on the flight deck was not at its best. And we got into Saigon, we refueled. And then leaving Saigon, you could plan leaving Saigon, which way you're going to go, because the Americans would send you anyway. Because, you know, they had operations going on. You could see bombers dropping bombs in place, you know, B-52s and things. So, you know, you had to do what they said. But Vic had planned one way to go, and that was the way Vic was determined to go. And the squadron commander was saying, but no, we shouldn't be doing this, Vic. We should be doing that now. And I was sitting there very new and very green. I think, what the hell's going on now? But, in fact, I think we left Vic's way, and surprisingly, we got away with it. I quite expect the Americans to be quite acid, but it was an interesting place, and that was an interesting game. And then up to Hong Kong, which was a lovely place to be again. You know, it was a great place in those days. A lot of the American R&R people up there, and carriers in the harbour, we used to do, because Hong Kong, particularly in those days, was a difficult place to get into, particularly in bad weather, we used to do training up there. We'd go up there and we'd do some training, and we'd do circuits. I can remember doing circuits inside the harbour, circuits and bumps at night with all the lights of Hong Kong. Lovely clear evening, absolute magic experience. Then we used to do training flights, and of course we take those all over the place, down into the Middle East, India. We also had a route flight that went to flew into Gan, and Gan was a big base in those days, and most of the menial stuff was done by Pakistani labourers, and we used to do changeovers of the Pakistani labourers. We'd fly out to Gan and then go up to Karachi with a changeover of the Pakistani labourers, and that was quite interesting, because they'd all get on the aeroplane with all their plastic buckets and all sorts of bits and pieces, which you obviously couldn't get in Pakistan in those days, and fly up to Karachi, spend the night in Karachi, then fly back down again. Always an interesting flight, because they were not the best at personal hygiene, and they weren't the best with the sort of food they ate. So the rear of the aeroplane could be a little bit challenging, shall we say, on those trips. So that was another commitment we had. We did, again, train as through India. I remember going on a route trip to India as well. Ceylon, as it then was, Katchanayaka, we used to go to. Thailand, I can remember going into we went up to Chiang Mai. And again, that was very early days before it really built up with the Americans. And we pitched up there and into the hotel, and there was a big banner at the hotel saying, "Welcome 48 Squadron," and which you, I suppose you'd get these days. And we wandered downtown. You could buy beautiful teak bowls and things for next to nothing. And very, again, an interesting place to visit. Australia we used to go down to. One of the jobs we did was the V-Force would come out and they'd go on exercise down in Australia. So we used to take their ground crew down there. So that was quite fun. We could, because we'd go down there with their ground crew. It could take a couple of days because you couldn't fly across Indonesia. I think they used to. They used to go so high that they could get across without any problem. But we had to go around. So it took 2 days to get down to Darwin, taking their crews. Then while we were down at Darwin, we had nothing to do because we were just there to take the ground crew back while they sat. So on occasions, they gave the FIAT said, "Oh, well, you can have so many hours flying around Australia." So I can remember going down to Alice Springs, and we sat there for a couple of days looking around Alice Springs. And I can remember walking back 8 miles to the airport from Alice Springs, because there was no transport, in a temperature about 80 degrees, not sweating at all because it was just so dry. And it was quite, I mean, Alice Springs these days is quite built up, but in those days there wasn't a lot there. We had quite fun at Darwin as well, because we used to get airborne with the in the Australian helicopters. They would take us flying, and we used to go chasing hawks and things there in the helicopters, and rounding up water buffalo, a lot of water buffalo around there. I remember going down the track with a couple of Australian guys, you know, in their cars, going for a barbecue down the track, shooting kangaroos, and coming back in the evening. And I didn't skin them and cut the meat, but the cooks did, and then we'd have barbecued kangaroo steaks in the evening. So, I mean, all experiences like that were absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible, you know, and made it just a great tour. It really was a wonderful tour. Then one trip, just retrace it, if that's all right. One of the jobs the squadron had when I first got there was they used to go out to Christmas Island, which is probably about 5 day flight out into the Pacific, and then they'd spend 6 weeks in Christmas Island. A crew would spend 6 weeks flying from Christmas Island up to Hawaii. Get bringing fresh vegetables and things like that for the people at Christmas Island. I was supposed to go on one of those trips, and my turn had come up, but I had to delay it because I was doing a promotion exam, which I'd failed the RAF law, so I had to resit that, so I postponed it. And then in the time that elapsed between me postponing it and when I was supposed to go out, they closed Christmas Island, so I lost my chance to go to Christmas Island. But to make up for it, they gave me a trip when the squadron commander was at the end of his tour, and he was just before he went home. He did a trip, and again it was one of these V-Force trips. He went out to Darwin, and then we were allowed so many hours for a training flight, but because we were starting at Darwin after a scheduled flight, we could go right out into the South Pacific. So we then went out to the Solomon Islands, Tahiti, Rarotonga, Tonga. And again, it was very much the fag end of the empire. There was still the old colonial office, district commissioners and people sitting there, and we flew around. Everywhere we went, it was round about Queen's birthday time, and we kept crossing the date line, and everywhere we went, we seemed to be the Queen's birthday parade. So, of course, we had to participate in that. And two memories from that. One was we met a guy. He's in his 80s then, but dressed in, you know, the Fijian and those, they have all their raggedy skirts, their uniforms, with the pith helmets and that. And this guy was dressed in that, and he was a guy who, I think he was a VC. He'd been left for dead by the Japanese. He'd had 40 bayonet wounds, and this guy had survived. A wonderful old guy, he really was. Quite incredible. The other interesting experience was on New Caledonia, which I see these days is French run, but in those days it was a joint French-British administration. And we stayed in a sort of bungalow with the district commissioner's place. It was a nice guy and a lovely family. And the highlight of their day was listening to the 6 o'clock news every evening on the long-wave radio to keep in touch. But the thing I remember there was that he had this young son who was about 8 or 9. And the son went to school in the town. And living in the compound, there was a little jail cell, was the local murderer who'd taken a hatchet to his mother-in-law, which some might have some sympathy with. But he was the chauffeur. So when the little boy went to school, the prisoner jumped in the car and drove him off to school. But eventually some of the locals complained about this because they didn't like the sight of this convicted murderer driving the commissioner's son about unsupervised. So then he had to have a policeman with him. So when the district commissioner's son went to school, the prisoner had to go and find his policeman, and they'd all jump into the car together, and that was all right then. But that was just a feel for those times, which would just say it was the end of the empire, and we were slowly withdrawing from there. But so that was, you know, it was again one of the joys of Changi, the contrast between the different forms of flying and the interesting places you went to, and it was just a lovely tour.
And the Borneo flights.
Borneo flights, again, were just exciting. We went out for a fortnight at a time, so you'd fly out, Brefman's passenger, in the back of a Bristol RNZAF 41 Squadron Bristol freighter, or Frightener as we knew them, which was, and we'd pitch up into Kuching. I say 48 Squadron, we were lucky because we stayed downtown in the Borneo Hotel, which was air conditioned and had a reasonable restaurant, shall we say. And then you go up to Kuching, the airport, each day, and you'd have tasking then to go out. And one of the problems there was a weather factor. And I can remember a couple of days running, getting airborne and going off to find a drop zone. And there were no aids at all. It was purely what you could find. And you're flying under cloud, and the cloud gets lower and lower, and the ground gets higher and higher. And in the end, you've got to turn around and come back. And you've got to be careful not to get too far into it before trying to turn around, because you might not have room to turn around. And 2 days running, we just dumped, you know, gallons and gallons of fuel out over the sea and landed back in, because you just couldn't get there, because you couldn't get to the DZs. The DZs were a lot of them were very difficult to find, because it was just unbroken jungle. So what they used to do was have an orange balloon filled with helium gas, which would stick up through the jungle canopy. The problem then, of course, was to get what you were dropping onto the quite a small DZ, which, I mean, if we missed, was no great problem to us. But the poor guys on the ground, if something was 100 yards off, it could be an absolute purgatory trying to recover it. One of the DZs we went to we took drums of fuel, because it was the Fleet Air Arm helicopters were operating at a place called Jambu, I think it was. And that was an interesting place because they'd... I suppose they have to build them where they can, but they'd built this little base where the helicopters were and where we had to drop the fuel for the helicopters at the top of a little hill. And the problem being that if you missed the top of the hill with these, when you were dropping this stuff, it rolled down to the bottom of the hill, and it was a devil's own job for them to get the fuel back up to the top of the hill for their helicopters. And in fact, on one occasion, I think we were talking to the people on the ground as you were doing this dropping, you know, trying to get some feedback as what was going on. And actually, one of the 40-gallon drums dropped through the hut where this guy was talking to us. But exciting flying and interesting flying. Another memory of that was again going back a bit when we were thrown out of Indonesia, and in fact, Roger was involved in removing the embassy staff and families from Indonesia. One of the people came out was a Guards Major, and he'd been given a gold watch by the Daily Mirror. Of course, he'd played the bagpipes on the steps of the Indonesian embassy while they were leaving. I suspect it caused the riot, the fact that the bagpipes are being played, but there we are. Anyway, he pitched up in Borneo eventually, and we went out one day and we dropped the loads at the various DZs. We had about four or five DZs to drop loads, one of which was his guards mob, another of which was to the Gurkhas. And of course, we dropped it in one order, and the army had laid it in another order, so that we dropped things in the wrong order. So that instead of getting his guards food, he got about 500 weight of Gurkha rice, which didn't impress him, and that duly appeared in the paper, so we weren't too impressed with that. But then again, I suppose we had done it. There was a lack of communication, so there was room for error.
Were any of the dropping zones particularly difficult?
Yes, yes. Jambu was not easy, because that was in hilly country. I can remember going, in fact, they'd found a new one and they wanted us to try it, and we slowly worked our way down into it. But I don't think it lasted long, because it was impossible. Because you were coming in over the mountains, you then had to cut all the power off and drop like a stone. And then when you got down to the sort of height you wanted to be at, get the power on, get levelled out, and fly level and drop this stuff, because you obviously couldn't, you had to be levelled to drop it, or else it would go down like a tremendous rate. And then weave your way out again, which was all very well as long as you had four engines working, because you know you had to get up height and get out. And so some of the places were very difficult, and I say were predicated on the fact that all your engines would keep working. But if they didn't, then you'd be hard pushed to find to get out. But say, great fun. I mean, at 24, you don't think about these things. You know, it's just absolute fun. Yeah. And the Queen's paying you. You know, this is the amazing bit. Yeah.
Can you tell me more about the flying conditions? Because they do sound quite distinctive.
Yes, it's a very disturbed region. The ITCZ is really basically because over the equator, the sun shines strongest over the equator. The air rises and then shifts north and south, and then it drops down again. That's as the air rises, it causes these big thunderstorms. So all the time, you were constantly had that problem of avoiding the thunderstorms, of thunderstorms over airports. I remember I mentioned earlier on that I went to a lunch where I wore the number 6 uniform. The Duchess of Gloucester came out, because she was head of the WAFs at that stage, as they then were. And so a big lunch was mounted at the Far East Air Force headquarters mess, which was just along the road from ours. And for some reason, I was invited as a representative of 48 Squadron to go to this lunch. And it was decreed that there would be a big flying display, and every aeroplane conceivable on was going to be in this flying display. So we had lunch, and the skies got darker and darker. And came the time for the flying display, which it had been decreed by the Air Marshal that it would take place. There was the most ginormous thunderstorm just covering Singapore. And they had aeroplanes going everywhere to get out of it. Some of them went up, you know, about 200 or 300 miles away, up country, to find somewhere to land. Helicopters were touching down wherever they could. And this was the sort of thing happened. You know, the big Sumatras is a sort of the meteorological name for them, were these big thunderstorms that came down the Straits of Sumatra, and they were just enormous. And so all the time there was this potential to find these things. And it's an unsettled area for weather, and of course in those days you didn't have the same sort of aids that we have now.
So how would you I'm wondering how you actually manage, you know, when you're actually flying, you've decided not to abort, it's good enough that you can just about keep going.
Somebody came up with this theory that if you're coming up to particularly the ITCZ and all these, there's just rows and rows of thunderstorms, that if you found the blackest part, that was the place to fly through it, on the basis that that was the decaying part, and all the airflow was sort of downwards or upwards, it wasn't varying. But I'm not sure anybody ever plucked up the courage to put that theory to the test. Literally it was a question that you would put it off as long as possible in the hope. Now, very often there were gaps through. You could work your way through the gaps. But on occasions, you know, you wanted to go to there. You were not going towards there when you were avoiding them. the only thing you had to do was to grit your teeth, turn and go and just go through them, and just be thankful that the Hastings was built like a proverbial, and you know, it coped. I mean, it was bad enough for the Argosies, I think, but at least they did have some radar, and they did have a weather radar to help them. But note that if you wanted to do the job, that's what you had to do.
And navigating, was navigating it.
Navigating could be a nightmare, particularly on the Hastings. I mean, again, the Argosy had a Doppler, which again, and I'll give you one instance. We did a trip to Gan and then back to Ceylon. It was about a 3-day trip, I think. So first day was out to Gan, second day up to Ceylon, then the third day was back to Changi, and we got airborne from Ceylon across the Bay of Bengal. The only winds we had to work on for the navigation were the winds that we'd passed on the way out. And we got airborne, we're at about 10,000 feet, and there was complete cloud cover below us. There was complete cloud cover above us because the main aid that our navigators used would be sunshots or star shots at night to plot their position. So there was none of that. We couldn't get a sunshot, and I think it went into night. So, the other thing you can do, which is not a great deal of help, is get a drift off of the sea. And if you can do a three drifts, you can get a wind out of it. Couldn't do that. So there we were with all these passengers down the backs, slogging across the Bay of Bengal in the middle of the night, really with no indication of where we were at all. Dawn came, and we eventually got a break in the cloud, and looking down we saw some land, a coastline, but only very small. In those days we had to assume that it was northern Indonesia, so we turned north to get out of Indonesian airspace and then west again. The only consolation in this situation is, you know, that if you fly west long enough you're going to hit land, because there's a Malay Peninsula and then Thailand and then Burma. Flogged on a bit longer until it cleared up, and then eventually found that we were way north of where we were supposed to be. And in fact the land we'd seen were the Carr Nicobar Islands. So that's as fate had it. So in the end, in fact, we landed at Butterworth. We'd had enough by then, so we landed at Butterworth rather than Changi, and went home next day. But that was a situation, you could literally get into this situation, and I'd say it only happened to me once, but where we had absolutely no means of navigating at all, and the ADF wasn't up to scratch. Very often, Mingan had a very powerful ADF beacon, but on this occasion, we weren't getting it. So we had absolutely nothing.
And navigating over Borneo, I'm assuming large patches of jungle, not many references?
No, just map reading. To a certain extent, you got to know it, because we went to the same DZs on the whole. There are perhaps, I don't know, a dozen, 20 DZs. So you got to know it, you know, with time. But basically, yes, just map reading. And, of course, the other problem was that some of the maps... unknown, you know, it wasn't properly mapped. So if the weather turned bad, then yes, you were struggling. I mean, they had a radar at Kuching, so you could get into Kuching. That wasn't the problem, but getting around the place, it was just the Mark One eyeball, really, and a map and experience. You know, and I've been there before.
Were you ever fired on?
No, not that I'm aware of. In the squadron crew room, we had four. A little box, glass top box with four bullets in it, which had been taken out of a Hastings, but it wasn't me, no. Not that I'm aware of, no. It was. But the interesting thing there was, in Kuching, I remember on several occasions seeing guys they called the Sarawak Rangers, I think they were called. And these were incredible guys, sort of SAS type people, I suppose, who were locally. Enlisted and worked for the sort of colonial office through there, I suppose. And these guys used to walk along the border, and you know, they'd go into the jungle and come out about 2 months later at the other end of the border, one end of the border, and come out at the other end of the border. And I think all sorts of things went on in there. There was a lot going on that we didn't really know about. But no, not personally.
Can you describe a typical drop for me? And in quite detailed, quite good. So I'm literally sort of what time you hit the airbase. And
yeah, well, so we probably get up there about, I suppose, about 8-ish, that sort of time. And then the tasking would come. The army would load up the aeroplane, hopefully in the right order, and tell us the right order of which DCV you're going to.
How long would that take?
Probably an hour and a half or something, just depending what you were dropping. we would sort of obviously look at the map, do the planning, fuel, this sort of thing. Work out how we're going to get there, what we're looking for. Navigator would probably sit in the nose and to do the map reading. Get airborne, set off on the tracks, obviously, and the route as planned. Map read your way around there. Probably fly over the DZ to let them know that you're there. They've probably heard you anyway. Prepare, the load would have been prepared by the guys down the back. Set up the pattern you're going to do. I say normally, I think it was about 800 feet we used to drop from. And so you needed time to get, you wanted to be flying straight and level as you hit the DZ. You wanted to be at the right speed. Inboard engines, throttle back, outboard engines at the power to give you about 100, I think it was 100, something like 140 knots. And then try and come in as steadily as you can on that heading. Drop the load. It might be the only load for that DZ. Just circle around, try and get some idea of where it had gone, particularly if you had other drops to do at the same place, and see whether you were early or late or how it was going. Carry out those drops and then map read your way to the next one. Looking out, particularly as you got close to it, and particularly some of them, the yellow balloon was the orange balloon was the only clue you had that where it was. And again, you'd set up your pattern, fly around and round, doing however many drops you needed into that place. And again, particularly that sort of place where it was quite a small DZ cut into the trees, then you really wanted to be as accurate as you could, so the guys had a chance in getting this stuff. And that pack would have gone for about 2 hours or so, you know, probably, depending on the number of drops you had to make. Jambu, I think we only ever just went out to Jambu and dropped the oil drums, because that was a load in itself. Come back back to Kuching, sit around, have a egg banjo. There was an Indian guy there running a little canteen, and a round roll with a fried egg on it, and or egg and bacon banjo. They were always known as egg banjos, and a big cup of fairly foul coffee or something, and then go out in the afternoon, do something similar, then knock off when you got back, and say we were lucky, we went downtown to the hotel. And till next day. Again, another interesting one on that was one of the things we used to do was what we call a free drop. The Ministry of Defence got fed up with how much it was costing in parachutes to keep all these places supplied. So to cut down the usage of parachutes, so there were certain things you could drop without a parachute. Things like rolls of barbed wire, fencing stakes, and at one stage chickens, but bits like that. So what you would do would be to you do your normal drops on parachute, then the last one would be a free drop with all the stuff that you could. One of the things we used to drop to the guys would be what they call the naffy pack. So you drop all the basic food and stuff, then the guys who were out in the jungle or something, they could, you know, their razor blades, shaving cream, or bits of magazines or something, the naffy pack would be dropped that they'd ordered, and which obviously made life a little bit more bearable for them. So you'd normally drop the naffy pack last, and they were out after that because they wanted all their cigarettes and all the rest of it as quickly as possible. And of course, the last thing we dropped, did the free drop, and I can remember on one we did, coming round on the free drop, and at 140 miles an hour, and the free drop was done very low level, about 50 feet. And of course, something dropped out at 140 miles an hour at 50 feet. You've got to drop it a long way ahead, and it hits the ground, and it just goes bowling along. And we'd just done that when we saw these guys on the DZ, after their naffy pack. And fortunately, no one was hurt, but it was a bit frightening for a minute, and because, I mean, a roll of barbed wire bouncing along the ground.